This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, computer geeks unite globally to solve real-world problems. Random hacks of kindness boots up with a hackathon in New Hampshire this weekend. And the pressure on scientists to sex up their research to get media attention. Also, whether you're on Team Edward or Team Jacob, a non-Twilighter is going to run through some of the swag aimed at fans, from body pillows to prophylactics. But first, clean coal refers to technologies that reduce heavy metal, carbon, and other emissions from the burning of coal. The development of technologies that could potentially filter greenhouse gases and store CO2 permanently is moving ahead. This week, a large demonstration of clean coal technology is being staged in Illinois, testing the viability of so-called carbon sequestration. It's an important step in testing the potential of clean coal technology. Maggie Kurth-Baker is science editor for Boing Boing, and she visited a similar demonstration in Alabama and is on the line with more. Maggie, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So what is carbon sequestration? Can you explain it to us?
Yeah, basically this is a way to make conventional fossil fuels a little bit cleaner. I don't like to say clean coal. I like to say cleaner coal because it's more of a reflection of what's actually going on. But basically you're filtering carbon dioxide out of the smokestack so that the carbon dioxide isn't getting into the atmosphere. It uses a lot of the same technology and geologic knowledge that's used to find and extract oil and natural gas. They're just doing this in reverse this time, putting something underground instead of taking something out of the ground. So the good thing is that you have less CO2 that's getting into the atmosphere. But the downside is that this is really expensive. It's not being done on a commercial scale anywhere yet. And it involves storing carbon dioxide under the ground essentially forever and having to monitor something for a much longer period of time than we've ever really done before.
Okay, so you have to take that byproduct and put it somewhere. Tell us about this new demonstration project. First of all, who's behind it?
It's the work of the Midwest Geological Sequestration Consortium, and this is one of seven regional organizations that the Department of Energy has around the country that are doing projects like this. What makes this one different is that it is a lot bigger than all but one of the other projects that's out there. Over the next 3 years, they're going to be storing 1 million metric tons of carbon dioxide underground. The other thing that makes this really important, and I think the thing that makes it the most important, is where they're getting this carbon dioxide from. So in the case of this project near Decatur, Illinois, that's going to be starting up this week, they're getting the CO2 from a nearby ethanol plant. It's basically just a part of the fermentation process of this ethanol plant. And they're compressing that CO2 into a supercritical form so it becomes like a liquid. And they send it by pipeline to the site, where it's piped down to about 7,000 feet underground and flows into porous sandstone beneath three layers of non-porous cap rock.
Okay, so I'm hearing two things here. The new project is going to store 1 million metric tons of CO2, also testing at an ethanol plant. Is this an accurate test? Is this the scale that we're looking for?
No, it's actually a lot smaller than the scale that we're looking for still. This project is going to, say, like I said, store 1 million metric tons of CO2 over 3 years, but a 550-megawatt capacity coal plant, which is kind of about the average size of a coal plant, would produce about 3 million metric tons of CO2 in a single year. So you'd still need something much bigger to do this at a commercial scale. But this is something, this particular project is now at a size that you could ramp up and scale up much easier from what they're doing.
It does sound like a science-driven project, but it could obviously have big implications for the coal industry and big energy. And I'm wondering, does this mean that big energy is acknowledging that human beings have a hand in generating carbon emissions and possibly a role in global warming? Is this an admission?
Yes and no. Right now, there does not mean a whole lot for industry yet. Right now, carbon capture and sequestration is kind of a PR thing for them. And it's really not going to be a whole lot more until there's some kind of price on carbon. So what they're really doing is, when they invest in things like this, is kind of hedging their bets and saying, you know, we think that there is a good possibility that somebody could say that we're going to regulate carbon dioxide emissions in the future, we want to have this technology available for us if that happens. The other thing is, though, that there is some demand for this commercially already in places like West Texas, where you can use some of that captured CO2 for advanced oil and gas recovery. So instead of just sending CO2 down under the ground, they send the CO2 under the ground, and it helps to release natural gas that is kind of trapped chemically to the substrate.
And Maggie Kurth-Baker is with us. She's science editor for the Boing Boing blog. And we're talking about a new demonstration that she visited this week that could lead us to cleaner coal. So this new facility that they're talking about, permanent storage of CO2 at a depth of 7,000 feet underground. So talk about the environmental concerns here. I mean, we've seen in the past that burying things in the ground has not always had the best track record for industry.
Yeah, so I think the key thing with this is that when environmental groups talk about their problems with carbon capture and sequestration, the key problem that they have is really the fear that this is going to be used as a crutch, that it's something that industry will sort of push through because maybe it's easier than developing alternative energy sources that are actually cleaner. And that's a reasonable concern, and it's something that we should not be using as a crutch, because there's not an infinite number of these good locations where you can safely store things underground. So, for instance, the Northeast in New Hampshire does not have a lot of available porous rock like the sandstone that they're using in Illinois, mm-hmm. and it would be really hard to find a site where you are that could actually be used for this.
So what is the potential for more carbon sequestration sites in the U.S.? Is this really being used as a test case? If this goes well, they'll keep moving on?
This is a test case. There's nobody doing this commercially right now, and this is actually the first time that anybody's done this at this kind of scale using actually man-made CO2. So in the past, all these other projects have been getting their CO2 from naturally occurring deposits, and then they put it in a truck and ship it cross country and pump it back underground again. So this is actually the first time that we're doing this in the way that it would be done in the real world, which is a good step. Where it goes from here is kind of hard to say. They had to spend quite a few years getting the funding for this project, and it kind of depends on whether or not we ever put a price on carbon where it goes.
Just wondering, who's monitoring this project?
Scientists, researchers from the University of Illinois are really leading this particular project, and they'll be monitoring the groundwater quality over, you know, the time that they're pumping down the CO2 and on into the future. That's part of their regulation.
Well, thank you so much, Maggie, for filling us in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maggie Kurth-Baker, science editor at boingboing.net. For a link to her blogs and for more about the so-called clean coal carbon sequestration, which she visited, click on over to wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. Now, coming up, a look at whether the social psychologists that are often producing some really interesting headlines are under pressure to sex up their research for more publicity, and maybe investors or grants. That's when Word of Mouth returns from New Hampshire Public Radio in just a couple minutes.
I don't believe that Tulsa has the right to say that your freedom of assembly expires at 11 o'clock. And that's why I volunteer for civil disobedience. I was arrested the second night.
I was one of the 10 that were arrested and pepper sprayed.
A total of 13 of us stood out there on the grass, and the police were coming up behind us. And I remember I was just thinking, okay, this is it.
As jazzed as I am to be thrown into the back of a police van, it's not about a personal thrill or personal fulfillment. It's about making sure that everybody knows this is a matter that's worth fighting for.
On one side would be freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and the other side would be the city's right to enforce the curfew. It's a law that the city put in place to keep the riffraff out of parks after hours. My name is Brian Horton. I'm a second-year law student. I go to law school. What we're going to do is file for an injunction. The injunction is to get the police to stop enforcing the curfew, saying that the right to protest, the right of free speech, is higher than the city's right to enforce the curfew.
To publicly gather and protest, express your grievances, is the most important thing in our society. If we don't have that ability, it's very difficult to make those grievances known, to make the true critical mass behind those protests known. That's where the power to change is drawn from, and that's why it's in the First Amendment.
Amendments to the Constitution of the United States of America.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion,
or prohibiting the free exercise thereof,
or abridging the freedom of speech,
or of the press,
or the right of the people peaceably
to assemble.
To assemble.
To assemble.
To assemble.
Do you know what assembly means?
Not really.
Not really?
That's what we've been doing. Peacefully assembling.
The right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances.
My name is Frank Grove.
My name is Anastasia Harlan.
I'm Marshall.
My name's Minnow Shrout.
I'm Minnow's mom. I'm Jerry McCaslin.
My name is Shannon Gus.
I'm Stephanie Lewis.
Samantha Pritchett.
I'm Daniel Lee.
And I'm a member of
Occupy Tulsa.
And, of course, the greater Occupy Wall Street movement.
The Occupy Wall Street movement has been up and down in the 24/7 news cycle, a hungry beast always prowling for the next headline. Word of mouth keeps its eyes out for stories that are interesting, counterintuitive, many of which come from the world of science. It's part of our mission to find the underreported, the simmering, the surprising ideas that make us think, what? But that demand for fascinating findings may be part of the problem, perhaps pressuring researchers to manipulate their data, even to make it snazzier. The recent scandal involving outright fabrications by social psychologist Diedrich Stoppel has raised questions of whether the system encourages transgressions. Christopher Shea recently wrote about dubious research practices for the Chronicle of Higher Education, and he's joining us today to illustrate the difference between the fudging and the nudging of the data. Christopher, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you.
Okay, so we're guilty. You know, the eye-catching, the bewildering results. We look for these kind of things that may be part of the problem. Are they?
That was one reason I did the study, the story, because I write about these kinds of studies, and when I read some of the criticisms of them, I wondered if I was, in fact, part of the problem. We're somewhat reliant on social scientists to police themselves, and we take the findings at face value, as I guess we have to. But it gets a little unnerving when someone says, well, actually, these findings may be the result of nudges or fudges, as you put it.
Diedrich Stoppel allegedly made up his data out of thin air. Now, you write about these much more subtle methods of influencing results and cite
right.
One study involving the Beatles. Can you tell us just about that study briefly?
Sure. Well, I mean, first of all, I think Stoppel did more than allegedly made it up.
Yes, he did.
He just flat out made it up. But yeah, there have been a couple of interesting recent articles in psychology journals. It should be said that they're voicing criticisms of themselves in their own journals, which is a good thing. But the researchers first demonstrated something kind of standard. They had people listen to a children's song, and afterwards, these people reported that they felt older. Listening to that kind of song, listening to a kid's song made you feel older. Not so surprising.
Mm-hmm.
Then they had... they had people listen to the Beatles' When I'm 64, referring obviously to, if not old age, older age, and people felt younger. Then they took it a step further and actually proved, quote, proved statistically that the people had actually gotten younger when they listened to this song. And their point was that you could play by the rules, by the statistical rules, and come up with an obviously false finding. And they offered they explained how they did it, and then they offered some suggestions for how to avoid this kind of thing.
You call it the odds of statistical bogosity grow.
Right.
When they don't actually have to report all the ways that they presented their data. But there a spectrum here, Christopher? I mean, do you think that researchers that work the data to sound sexier are the same? Can we equate it with those who eventually falsify things entirely?
Well, that was the inspiration for the article I wrote were some comments by another Dutch psychologist, Erik Jan Wagenmakers, and he did make that striking comparison. He was saying that there was this guy Stoppel was an outright fraud, but then he said there wasn't much of a difference between making up your data and torturing your data, which was kind of an inflammatory charge and probably overstated. I think these other more moderate criticisms are just saying that there's a combination of things, just that a subtle desire. Well, people want their experiments to work out. Mm-hmm. You don't want to spend all this time and discover nothing. And that impetus plus enough freedom to look at the data in all sorts of different ways and probe it and look for connections, and then not to explain all of that probing and exploration when you finally write up the study, that leads to problems. I think the phrase that one of these papers used was researcher freedom of, I don't know, maybe just researcher freedom.
Mm-hmm.
If you get a lot of time and the more comparisons you make basically in a big data set and the more you look for connections, the more likely you are to find random connections. And that's okay if you then either confirm that stuff or explain everything, all the probing you did. If you write it up as if you just did a narrow study and found this one thing, that's when problems arise.
Right. And there are bigger questions here of, getting headlines often leads to getting investors, getting funding, getting grants, getting a lot of attention. Do publications and journals agree that the press attention is perhaps influencing results?
Well, they don't. I talked to the editors of a couple of the more prominent journals and journals that had published some of this flashy stuff and that had published Stoppel. And they say that just it doesn't, the amount of press attention you get is just not at all a factor in whether they decide to publish. I heard somewhat different things talking to some younger researchers who say that there's pressure in general. There's pressure to get published, and it's kind of natural. If your research gets picked up by the New York Times, that gets noticed. The University Public Relations Office notices it. It goes on the website of your blog. I mean, of your department. Maybe it does have an effect.
Well, with just a minute left, of course, social science research is not the only thing that gets picked up very quickly. Medical research, it seems like any new weight loss, anti-aging study gets just as much, if not more, media attention. Is that field potentially as guilty of researching for headlines?
I think one complaint that psychologists had about my story was that I focused, one, too much on social psychology because of this Stoppel fraud, and too much on psychology in general when these are basic statistical problems. Every social science field faces them to one extent or another, and these debates have also been raging in biomedicine. There's a Stanford statistician who's gone so far as to say that 50% of all medical research is wrong, and he makes he's got methodological complaints about how people are analyzing connections between genes and disease.
Christopher,
treatment.
I'm so sorry I have to pull you off right there. We're out of time.
Sure.
But I really want to thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Christopher Shea blogs for The Wall Street Journal. You can find more on the article at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Random hacks of kindness matches software coders, developers, and programmers with the world's most pressing needs. What began with Microsoft, Google, Yahoo, NASA, and the World Bank, and a bunch of volunteer geeks designing apps for disaster and crisis management, is now a global movement. This weekend, hackathons are convening in many cities, including Manchester, New Hampshire, and they are looking for people interested in changing the world one app at a time. Rebecca Kramer is director of IT for Small Dog Electronics, a family-owned business of Apple specialists originating in Vermont. They're on the line to tell us more about the weekend event. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
So what are some examples of problems Random Hacks of Kindness has worked on in the past?
Well, it kind of runs the gamut. One of the popular ones that's being developed right now is an app to help firefighters. It uses Bluetooth on Android and iPhone devices to check firefighters in and out of the trucks when they get on and off. And also while they're actually in a facility, it is able to use GPS and the accelerometer on the phone to ensure that the firefighter is still alive and moving around.
Well, that's a great example.
So
are you still with me, Rebecca?
I sure am.
Okay. You were going to give me another example, I believe.
Yes. So another example is a commodity tracking app that's being used in Haiti. So we have a lot of resources going to Haiti right now, a lot of goods, but unfortunately not the best ways to track those goods. So one of the things that this app is striving to do is giving people who have commodities, for example, rice, a place where they can go online on their mobile device, say they have rice selling for this certain price, and then someone who's looking for rice in that area can get on and get the best prices for goods that are close to them.
So what are they going to be doing this weekend in Manchester?
So this weekend's going to be the first time that Manchester is actually participating with Random Acts of Kindness. We're throwing an event over in the Mill District in one of Gigunda Group's buildings, and we're going to be bringing together software developers from the community and hopefully nonprofit organizations from the community and pairing them together and helping them solve different problems for the local community and the global community.
So this is still open to the public. I mean, if someone may be skilled or even interested in programming and design may wonder, how could I help? What would you tell them?
Anyone is welcome. That's the beautiful thing about these events. So it's often geared towards people who are in college, who are just learning the different software development skills, and also professionals who are out there so that they can learn new skills. But even if someone's in the community and they're just interested in learning how to code, it can be a really great way to do it. Oftentimes people come to these events because they have some skills. Maybe they're great with web design, maybe they're great with PHP, but they've never designed a mobile app. And they can end up leaving with new skills. They can learn how to design for Android, for iPhone, or people who already have those skills might end up learning some web skills.
It's so interesting to think of because, I mean, a lot of these people, developers, coders, programmers, often highly connected, but also kind of existing extremely anonymously. Is there a value in actually having these people meet up and see each other in person?
There is. It's a really great networking tool because developers always need to work with each other. No one has every single skill set out there. So the main purpose is to bring them together so that they can help with these global issues. But in the long run, this is just wonderful for networking, and you meet people with different skills, and then you can go from there building your business.
And what do they get? I mean, they come, they arrive, they get a problem to solve. Is that how it works?
They do. So when they get there, we have a list of problems that we're going to be focusing on this event. and people get to split up into groups and choose the problem that is most interesting to them. Then after they code, which they can do for up to 48 hours, they're welcome to do it overnight if they'd like to, we do have time for them to present their problems to the group and also to judges, and then they get to win some cool prizes.
Well, is there any kind of interface with the global Random Hacks of Kindness? I know these events are going on all over the world on this same weekend.
It's true. So we're going to have a Ustream interface that allows us to broadcast for free our event, and a lot of other events are going to have that as well. They also have some Skype chats going on, and we certainly will be hitting the social media channels. So that is one way that we can be connected to all of the different events. And also, anyone who can't attend an event is welcome to tune in.
So what are people going to walk away with? Will they have a new app to solve a big problem?
In general, you can't fully solve a problem in 2 days. It's not realistic. So the idea is to get as much done as possible. Now, that might be having a really firm concept. It hopefully will be going a bit further actually into the development of solving the problem. But from there, all of the problems are open source. So they'll be hosted on different open source repositories where people can then go home and continue to work on those problems. And other developers who might have more time can also tune in and continue where everybody left off.
Do people have to register first, Rebecca?
We appreciate it if they do. We do have a website on rock.org, so that's www.rhok.org, and you can find the Manchester event in there. And it is completely free. In fact, we'll even feed you. So you can just sign up for a ticket on there.
We'll also have a link to that at wordofmouthradio.org. Good luck, Rebecca. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Rebecca Kramer, Director of IT for Small Dog Electronics, which is one of the sponsors of New Hampshire's very first Random Hacks of Kindness event in Manchester this weekend. It is just one of many simultaneous hackathons going on around the world this weekend. And as we mentioned, you can find more information and a place to submit problems at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also help Word of Mouth by following us on Facebook and on Twitter. And on to another do-gooder makeover. Just shy of their 100th birthday, the Girl Scouts are working to shed their cookie and campfire image with new badges that focus on skills like robotics, chemistry, and engineering. They're also trying to recruit more urban and minority Girl Scouts. Elliot Majerzik reports.
As the Girl Scouts approach their centenary, no one wants to lose what they're all about. Things like badges for arts and crafts and nature skills. But the 3.2 million member organization has just added new badges in technology, math, and even web design.
They learn how to do algebra, activities with robots. We have a person who helps them build rockets. They're learning about science, they're learning about math, but it's fun.
That's Sandra DeLoach, and one of the new badges, the STEM patch, has been created in her honor.
STEM is an acronym for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics.
Sandra DeLoach is the interim provost and vice president for academic affairs at Norfolk State University and a lifelong member of the Girl Scouts.
Our goal is to make sure that girls recognize that they can achieve in these disciplines just like boys.
9-year-old Nicole Fries, who lives in Connecticut, is an example of this new generation of technically savvy Girl Scouts. She just won a national award for building a miniature rocket.
It was actually really, 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 really cool because, you know, I didn't really know that much about all this rockets and stuff, and now I actually figured out, like, what the parts of a rocket are called and how to make a rocket.
It's exactly this kind of opportunity that Sandra DeLoach would like to bring to inner-city girls. She's introducing more minority girls to scouting.
Sometimes in the urban areas, girls don't have the opportunity to participate in those things that we feel are character-building, confidence-building, to make good career choices.
Sandra DeLoach also says that today's Girl Scouts are benefiting their communities. Some of the new badges are for community outreach.
I know there was one project where a young girl actually had to develop some construction skills to develop a playground for a group of kids. Just unbelievable things that they do.
In fact, Sandra has a prediction.
We always like to say that there's so many prominent women who were Girl Scouts that we know the first president of the United States of America who's female will have been a Girl Scout.
For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Elliot Majerzyk.
Coming up, vampires to cuddle up with and other curious Twilight-related products targeted to teenage girls and young women. That's when Word of Mouth returns from NHPR in just a moment. Welcome back. Holiday movies offer a brief respite from the seasonal rush of family, food, gifting, and for one blockbuster series, humanity. Over the Thanksgiving holiday, Breaking Dawn Part 1 was by far the box office champ. The third installment in the Twilight saga has raked in more than $500 million since it opened 2 weeks ago. At that time, many Twihards, as devotees are called, camped out near theaters in anticipation of midnight showings across the country. Critics have not been so rabid. One advocated for putting a stake in the franchise. That has not stopped merchandisers from creating a far-ranging assortment of Twilight-ish products. We asked producer Taylor Quimby to survey some of the glittering and peculiar items being marketed towards fans. Hi, Taylor.
Hello.
So, before we talk about the Breaking Dawn products currently on the market, keeping in mind that the saga is far from over
right,
yet.
More to come.
I should ask you, have you seen the movie?
I have to admit, I haven't. I saw the first movie, Twilight, on DVD. I think it was 2009. And because I couldn't keep myself from expressing indignation at certain perceived fronts to vampire mythology, I think they can be in sunlight, but they sparkle, which is why they don't. And also, most of the main characters live in Seattle because of the cloud cover.
Right.
So that they don't sparkle. I mean, that was a tough sell for me. I realized it would be unfair to watch any of the other films with people around me, because I just can't stop myself from talking.
But I guess you have a Twilight sort of authority close by.
I do. My other half, Tiffany, took her sister to see Breaking Dawn last week, so I was able to get a brief synopsis of the film from her. But listeners should be warned, we're heading into major spoiler territory. So plug your ears if you don't want to hear what happens.
Do you think you can try and sum up the plot of Breaking Dawn in, you know, like 20 words or less?
In 20 words or less.
Okay, 30 words or less.
Okay, so here it goes. They get married, honeymoon, sex, pregnant, she almost dies, she comes back as a vampire. End of the movie.
Whoa, that's about the most brief summary I've heard so far. Thank you very much to Tiffany for that.
Right, yeah. She did a really good job with that.
I don't think that's giving away any more than we've seen in many of the reviews, by the way, but there is a lot more to this story. The Twilight t-shirts, stickers, backpacks, and the books and the all sort of related DVDs. But what else is out there for Twilight products?
Well, I personally would divide Twilight merchandise into three different categories. First is what I'm calling the false idols. And I think these range anywhere from vaguely innocent-sounding Twilight Barbies to the highly suspect Edward Cullen body pillow, or Manlo, as it's advertised on Etsy. For those of you who don't know, Edward Cullen is Twilight's vegetarian vampire heartthrob, played by Robert Pattinson, who coincidentally starred in actually another multi-film franchise. He played Cedric Diggory in the Harry Potter films. And to be fair, they have also inspired some pretty weird products, like I think there's the Harry Potter sock yarn, but I think that's so much less creepy than a life-sized vampire-shaped pillow of Edward Cullen, which, I might add, sold out.
Oh.
Also on my list of false idols is the Edward Cullen shower curtain, a nice touch if you want to recreate the shower scene from Psycho on a daily basis, and of course, the full-sized cardboard cutout. I think that's kind of a classic. This time of Taylor Lautner, who in the film plays the young werewolf Jacob Black.
All right, so body pillow for young teenage girls, presuming. What else? Makeup?
Good guess. I've more or less lumped beauty and fashion products into the second category, and there's a few things to talk about here. Some of this stuff is disturbing for obvious reasons, and I'm thinking about the glow-in-the-dark soap with Edward's face on it. Another creative soul thought to paste a tiny photoshopped Edward Bella love scene onto a single Scrabble tile and make a necklace out of it. I thought that was really dashing.
And showing some sort of can-do spirit, I suppose.
Exactly. Very creative.
But these aren't the mass-produced products available on the rack of the big box stores. These are pieces of handmade fan merchandise. If people don't know Etsy, it is a website for crafting.
Absolutely. And there's other stuff on eBay that there's, you know, probably only a handful of these made by some real diehard fans. But not all of it. Twilight's author Stephanie Meyer helped to design one of the official Twilight tie-ins, a replica of Bella's engagement ring from the film.
An engagement ring from Twilight.
Mm-hmm. There is actually three versions of the ring that they made for people of different incomes. So the highest priced, obviously made with diamonds, is about $2,000. And then there's two versions with cubic zirconium, one at about $500 and the other at about a very reasonable price of $35.
For what, the teenage market?
I would think so. I would guess so.
All right, now the third category of Twilight merchandise. Do I want to know what that is?
Well, as you might have guessed, everything else falls into sort of this amorphous, miscellaneous pile. This is where you'd find the Breaking Dawn baking dish, which says Baking Dawn. Took me a little while to see that, actually. The reusable Twilight baby diapers. Tiffany was actually pretty excited about those. We do have a three-month-old. Twilight toilet paper and probably the weirdest is the Twilight condoms, which, by the way, I feel obligated to mention my personal opinion. I don't think you should trust a condom marketed after a film in which a teenager is unexpectedly impregnated by a vampire.
I'm not sure that condoms marketed after a film, any film, are good ideas.
I think that's pretty sage advice. I'm thinking, like, Muppet condoms? No.
All right, so it is tough for me to ask. I mean, this stuff must sell.
You know, the first thing that a lot of reasonable people think, and I shouldn't call Twilight fans unreasonable, but from my perspective, you know, I thought, does anybody really buy this stuff? And the truth is, absolutely. I asked Tiffany the same question, being that she is a Twilight fan, and she had a pretty valid response, although, as you can hear, I was in a little bit of denial. Do you think people buy this stuff? I mean, if they make...
Of course people buy these things. It's like the same thing when people did, like, Lord of the Rings. There's still people, like, obsessed about, like, other movies.
Yeah, but
like
it's not the same because Lord of the Rings is cooler.
I didn't say that it wasn't cooler. I'm just saying that it's, like, this, on the same lines and stuff. When people get, like, obsessed about something, it's, like, the same idea. Star Wars, all those things. People dress up like them.
No, but Star Wars is cooler, too.
Oh, my God.
Okay, Taylor, what I'm hearing here is you're saying science fiction cool. Twilight not. I mean, this is a franchise that is primarily marketed and sold to teenage girls and their mothers, it seems. I think there's a lot of mom-daughter kind of bonding over Twilight going on. So it's just not cool as far as you're concerned.
She's absolutely right. The only reason I haven't dressed up as a hobbit for Halloween is because I haven't gotten the chance. In my defense, Twilight has inspired, I think, some admirably crazy fans. There's a YouTube clip that might give you an idea. This is a woman who filmed herself watching the trailer for Breaking Dawn for the first time. And remember, this is before the movie hit theaters.
I don't even know where to start. I'm actually really nervous about this, and I don't even know what to say. Same old rules. Turn your speaker down. Please don't watch the video if you don't like swearing, because I will be. Oh my God, I just have to watch it now. I've waited so long for this. Breaking Dawn trailer. Full screen. Oh my God, it's a wedding in me!
So that's...
Well, I don't know what's odder, that she's doing it or that she chooses to show this of herself on a video.
Well, and that's what I thought, but I guess, you know, they're proud. They're proud Twilight fans, proud to buy Edward Cullen Manlows.
Well, Taylor, you're clearly not a 13-year-old girl, but we still appreciate you doing such due diligence on figuring out what was out there for the Twilight fan.
Well, thank you for having me. And I should add that these were all, of course, my own opinions, and they don't reflect NHPR or anybody
else. Board
of
directors.
Exactly.
Okay, you can go back to your desk now.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, Taylor Quimby there, our producer and self-identified non-Twihard. For links to some of the surprising and, dare I say, disturbing Twilight swag he found around the web, you can go to wordofmouthradio.org. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby, Virginia Prescott,
and Rebecca Lavoie, with oversight and direction from Abby Goldstein, NHPR's Vice President of Programming,
and web support from Brady Carlson,
and Courtney Kenya.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals,
not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
For information about the show,
to subscribe to our podcast, post a comment,
or to read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at Word of Mouth. Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
New Hampshire Public Radio.